Right. My name is Stephen Nicol, and I'm going to chair this evening's activities. And I'd like to welcome our two speakers, Giles Keating and Michael Hughes. Giles, I know well because I remember teaching him here. But Michael was also here when I was teaching here, but I don't remember him. Anyway, what we're going to talk about today is the coming world recession. Will Britain escape? Which sounds quite dramatic, and our speakers, I think, have quite strong views. What's going to happen is that they are going to both speak for about a quarter of an hour, 20 minutes, and then when they've finished, you get a chance to lob questions or make comments, which we hope will be pertinent, and we'll have a discussion. And that will go on until roughly quarter to seven, quarter to eight, at which point we'll go to the reception in the senior common room upstairs. So we will start with Giles, who's going to make the first presentation, and off you go.
Thanks very much, Steve. So I think I'm going to answer, yes to the question, will Britain escape? But I guess I'm then going to come on and qualify that fairly heavily by first of all making the comment that, you know, pretty obviously Britain's industrial sector, which, like any major industrial economy, is by far the most volatile part, is already in quite deep recession. And then I think I'm also going to perhaps draw attention to the fact that there are fairly good reasons for thinking that the sort of recovery from this global recession will actually illustrate sort of fairly weak pricing performance globally. And that will be one of the kind of perhaps things that will dominate the outlook as we come out of the recession. Anyway, let's. But I should say that one of the kind of key reasons why I think Britain will escape the recession is that it has seems to have a really very wide margin for policy manoeuvre on both the fiscal and the monetary side, and that wide margin does appear to be being used. So let's come on and look at some pictures to justify this. I've got quite a lot of pictures, so I'll try and whip through these. So first of all, just beginning with a few slides looking at the kind of the shape and the nature of the current global cycle. And this chart is just meant to illustrate the point, and I'm, you know, obviously the last points here do include some forecasts, which may or may not be right. But certainly, as far as one can currently gauge, it does seem that the US recession is likely to be a fairly shallow one. We're looking at two-year moving averages here, and on a two-year moving average, we don't think it will actually dip into negative. Obviously, it almost certainly will do on for a couple of quarters, so it will be technically a recession. And if you look back over the history of this, you can see it doesn't look as though it's going to be that deep. By contrast, however, the global recession does look as though it really will be quite deep, or global downturn. And in fact, certainly according to the sort of guesstimates we put together here, it would actually be the deepest across the whole of this 50-year period. So that's quite an important starting point. US shallow, but the global picture really quite deep. And really, at least mechanically, the reason for that is that that Asia is so weak. You know, Japan, we all know, is doing very badly. Non-Japan Asia, for a variety of reasons, not so much connected with Japan, although that's an influence, but connected with the weakness of the US tech cycle, Non-Japan Asia also doing very badly. And I mean, if you look at this chart, historically, non-Japan Asia and Japan between them typically ran at a kind of 5-6% rate, and sort of didn't come that much below that even in the global slowdown periods. But those days are long gone, and that's really kind of one of the key points. And as we'll see in a moment, because they've been investing heavily, it means there's lots of spare capacity slopping around. It also means that I think one of the reasons why perhaps some of the policymakers may have been just a little bit slower to react than they might have been earlier this year, I'm not necessarily talking about the UK, is that they didn't realize that we'd have this kind of backdoor effect where the US slowdown, kind of the main transmission effect into Europe, was via its effect on Asia and consequently back into Europe. They were looking west, they should have been looking east. So, as I said at the beginning, weak nominal GDP likely to be one of the sort of features of this cycle. There are some estimates for you, and I mean, kind of we're halfway through the fourth quarter, and so at least for the fourth quarter, we've actually kind of getting to some quite good data, and it does look as though we will have very, very soft nominal GDP in the US here. So why is that? Well, it really relates back to that point about the weakness of Asia. And again, I mean, you can play around with output gaps indefinitely, but even if you don't agree with the exact numbers, some sort of flavor of this, I think, is right. And it's really saying we are opening up really quite a substantial output gap, probably will continue to do so into at least the first half of next year, even in the second half, possibly, you're beginning to narrow the output gap, but you'll still be left with quite a substantial gap. So the depth of that slowdown in Asia really combining with the slowdown elsewhere to really give us, and combining with the investment boom that we've been through, to give us some quite big output gap effects here. Now obviously, you can debate around this, how much of the capacity is sort of been written off or is no longer useful, etc. But I think as a broad point, it's very helpful background. And of course, illustrated in some of the very weak prices paid data that you're getting out of the US NAPM and the Euro area PMI. All right, so that's sort of something on the global background. What about now the UK position? And really, just as, you know, just to remind ourselves, and this is the point I made at the beginning, while it's very legitimate to be debating this, will UK escape recession in GDP terms? Obviously, in industrial terms, UK is already well into recession. In fact, is actually, in some sense, probably underperforming the global picture a little bit here. But obviously, aggregate growth looking fairly resilient. And interestingly, on these estimates, it looks as though it's in year-on-year terms, UK's just crossed over and is actually growing faster than the global average, which is pretty good. And of course, it's this dichotomy between the service and production sectors that's doing that. All right, so what are the short-term survey indicators telling us around the world? Well, they're sort of pointing pretty strongly downwards here. If we kind of superimpose the corresponding UK survey on that, if we look at the SIPS survey, then we find that the UK series here seems to be outperforming the NAPM. If we looked at the CBI survey, which I've not put on here, then you'd in fact have the UK sort of tracking the US NAPM pretty closely. So if you just really put all of that lot together, the actual data on what's happened to production and the survey data, I think we're really saying that the UK is certainly not escaping the industrial component of this global downswing. What about the consumer? I promised Steve I wouldn't say too much about the consumer, but here we're just looking at the US position in terms of the relationship between consumer confidence and the savings ratio. Sort of the literature on the savings ratio at time of war incident is quite interesting. It's not at all clear that you actually have savings ratios going up in time of war. There's certainly a strand of both theory and empiricism which suggests that they may go, the savings ratio may come down as people's sort of, discount rate comes down. They sort of, get out and save before they're sort of, they get killed kind of thing. Get out and spend before they get killed. And I mean, certainly we look back to the Gulf War experience, then what we found was that we had this sort of brief moment where the savings, in fact, you can scarcely see it, but at the beginning of that sort of first dotted line, sorry, between the first dotted line and the second dotted line, you can see you did get a little bit of a rise in the savings ratio, not very dramatic. And then we had a big confidence rebound, and in fact the savings rate came back down again. It's on an inverted scale here. And it's sort of, I mean, I think what's going on this time is slightly different in the sense that there's probably a kind of, if you want to, well, I don't know if you want to call it structural or whatever, there's a sort of an adjustment to the savings ratio going on here, a sort of balance sheet adjustment, which is kind of going on simultaneously with the wartime effect. But probably what's going to happen is where savings ratio shot upwards and it will now reverse some of that. And that's obviously what the latest data. But anyway, we come on to that in detail if people want. Anyway, the result of all of this is the contrast between US and UK, with the UK consumer looking really quite robust now relative to the US one. If we look, however, at the consumer confidence data, then we get a rather different picture. And again, you know, there's a sort of variable relationship here, but certainly there's some evidence from the consumer confidence that maybe we can be looking to a bit of softening of the consumer as we go ahead. And that, so that I think is a sort of important background point. And it really sort of comes down to the idea that policy has got quite a job to be doing here. Let's just skip over that. And then just briefly to talk about the export side, obviously we've got this sort of ongoing negative contribution. And I think perhaps a couple of points here just to make. One is that if you actually look at current account credits outside of the EU, then in some ways the UK does look a little bit less exposed to the external picture. So that may be one kind of hint about why we've on the consumer side at least had this slightly better or more insulated performance. And then the other quite interesting thing is to look across the regions, and there what we find is that the UK is much sort of disproportionately exposed to the US, while the EU is disproportionately exposed to this thing called REST, which contains a lot, of course, of Eastern Europe in it. Anyway, I mean, I think the net effect of all of this, and perhaps the really big point to draw out, since kind of policy is almost the focus in deciding whether we're going to suffer here or not, is the net effect is that the current account is well within what I would regard as the comfort zone. And I mean, I haven't attempted to go off and estimate sort of, you know, really what we think sustainable capital flows might be. But the UK, like a number of other countries, it seems to be the case that as you kind of approach or bust through this 4.5% of GDP level, that's a kind of, somewhere around there tends to be a sort of danger area for current account performance. Interestingly enough, that's exactly where the US external account is now hovering around. And so I just make the point that we're way away from that, which is perhaps not as scientific as one would wish it to be, but it sort of tentatively leads to the conclusion that we shouldn't be looking to, as it were, perhaps thinking, being too concerned that we're going to run into a sort of exchange rate problems here. That's not the same as saying we may not get the exchange rate sort of edging a bit one way or the other, although recently in trade weighted terms continues to be remarkably stable. But it's saying it's unlikely that this is going to create a major constraint on policy. I think that's the key takeaway from this. And if we just perhaps quickly glance at domestic balance sheets, then what we find is that we have experienced a deterioration in balance sheets. And so this is definitely a kind of potential concern. And I think sort of fits with the idea that you certainly need some stimulus here to, quite substantial stimulus to avoid this kind of problem getting out of control. And this certainly fits with the idea that profits are under pressure against that very, very weak pricing background that I've talked about. Again, it hints perhaps at another clue to what's going on here, which is that the consumer is benefiting from all that spare capacity around the world, which is squeezing the corporates. So corporates under pressure here. And this is just another sort of illustration of that. Not catastrophic, because obviously, as interest rates have come down, the income, that's put a brake on the extent to which income gearing has gone up. But potentially concerning, and certainly would have been very concerning if we hadn't seen the rate reductions that have been delivered. All right, now coming on to sort of some of the sort of background to policy a little bit more closely, and clearly one, I put this in for Steve's benefit particularly, one of the features of the UK economy is obviously that labour market flexibility has been improving dramatically. And you can see that across a number of indicators, the sort of decline in the tax wedge there, the replacement rate at a low level, and the union density. This is actually taken from a paper by Steve Niffle and some of his collaborators, so he may have some comments to put me right on the interpretation of this a little bit later. And anyway, that seems to be having the effect of lowering the Nairu. Well, now, but it kind of is the Nairu low enough? Well, we've sort of, you know, just did a quick comparison around the world, and this is looking at the US first of all. We popped in a couple of measures of the Nairu. One looking at a kind of IMF sort of static estimate, and another, a very, very crude sort of city economist's trick, if you like, of just running an HP trend through to see if you sort of bust through it. And the implication is that in the US, you are now looking at a labour market that has dramatically gone from a kind of overheating to an environment of quite substantial slack over the space of really about sort of 6 or 9 months. So it's been a very, very rapid turnaround there. And that, if you like, is part of the background to the Fed easing. The euro area, interestingly enough, and again, you know, perhaps just sort of illustrating some of the caution from the ECB, the euro, you know, whichever of these sort of measures you use, it does look as though unemployment is still well below the Nairu here, and that's sort of consistent with some of the wages data. But you know, as you look through next year, perhaps that starts to narrow. But now, perhaps a bit controversially, in the UK. It does look as though here also we are running with an unemployment rate below the Nairu. But the savings grace, of course, is that this just is not coming through in the wages data, presumably because whatever the pricing pressure that I've talked about is implying that there's, I don't know, I mean, it's an issue. So that certainly is a slight question mark, I think, as to the policy background. Now, fiscal policy, I think things are probably clearer. Here, we're looking at some degree of improvement in terms of debt to GDP ratios across the board in US, Euro, and UK. Obviously, things are blowing up in Japan. And I think the message here, of course, is though that in absolute terms, these ratios are still looking pretty high in the Euro area. The really good sort of performance in absolute terms is confined to the US and the UK. And so you would expect the US and the UK to be taking advantage of that slack. And if we go away and look at what is happening to fiscal policy, and these are cyclically adjusted data, obviously next year's are sort of estimates, then it does, you know, Japan aside, where you know, everything is odd in Japan, but Japan aside, it does appear that you get the result that you would expect, which is you get the exact ordering. The euro area has got the least room for manoeuvre in terms of the absolute level of its debt to GDP ratio, and it is relying the least on fiscal policy. Then came the US, and finally the UK. Now, in practice, there may be a sort of a bit of a fortuitous element here in terms of sort of mid-term political commitments. That were kind of in place already for spending programs. So the policy, the fiscal policy in the UK is a funny sort of mixture of sort of design and accident, I think, in terms of what it's doing to doing. But it's clearly very helpful, and I would put this as it were one of the sort of key building blocks to the, you know, my supporting the contention that the UK will escape the global recession. And now, monetary policy, and I mean, I certainly would not go to the state for the sort of slightly Mickey Mouse policy reaction functions that we've estimated here. But I mean, I think, you know, obviously what we've done here is a sort of kind of modified Taylor rule. We've estimated interest rates on output gaps and on inflation rates. But I mean, the interesting thing that this is suggesting is that perhaps both globally and in the UK, policy has now moved a little bit, if you like, ahead of the curve or ahead of the way that those driving variables in the based on past performance would be suggesting that things should go. In the case of the global picture, this is saying that by the time you get a bit more slowdown feeding through, a little bit more will have to have been done. In the case of the UK, interestingly enough, this particular chart, and you know, obviously you can go and estimate these in different ways and get different results, but this particular one is saying that that in fact enough has been done already, and just holding rates here will kind of bring them in line with what certainly past policy reaction would suggest was appropriate. So without perhaps getting too much into the weeds of this, I think, again, the conclusion I would draw from this is kind of it's supportive of yes, the UK will escape global recession because we've got the expansionary fiscal policy that I've just shown you, and we've got now the monetary policy, which is running a little bit ahead of where sort of past behavior would suggest that perhaps it should be. That's taken from a Fed paper and is quite interesting, but perhaps we'd come back to that later. And finally, just to sort of point out that and that this has got the sort of latest moves, which have seen the sterling weakening a little bit against the dollar, but sort of moving actually fractionally up against the euro. So incredible stability continuing in terms of the exchange rate. So the exchange rate here is not playing any kind of policy role, if you like, if I sort of dare use that word for a sort of endogenous thing, but it's except in the kind of passive way of not providing any kind of constraint. It's not the case that we're at risk here of a weakening which might start to act as a constraint on domestic policy. Thank you very much.
Well, that was a great tour d'horizon. So Michael Hughes will now present us with his views.
Sorry, that's a fraction long.
It's all right.
Good evening.
Yeah.
I've got very fond memories of this theatre, not least because I spent many an hour on that back row with a fellow student, not least because this particular theatre has a reputation for light failure, particularly if any audiovisual aids are used, which may partly explain why Steve never saw me, but certainly explains why that fellow student then became my wife. But today, and partly because of that experience, I'm staying well clear of the audiovisual aids, not least to ensure that I don't cause any mishap. The brief that we've been given is to investigate whether the UK can escape the current downturn. And my answer is going to be, yes, it can. Indeed, a very famous fellow, not just student, but also staff member, has already stolen a march on us by announcing that there's a 1 in 10 chance of our having a recession. That's Mervyn King. But what I would like to go on to argue is that the sensitivity of the UK economy to global events is actually going to increase arguably quite dramatically in the next few years. And that because of that, the ability to escape the next downturn is somewhat impaired. And then I will go on to discuss whether I think there will be a next downturn. So let me begin firstly by considering why we are escaping the current one. Well, if you look at the factors that have led to most of the major economies turning down in recent months, it's very difficult, I think, to get a common reason. In fact, if you were a gambler, it's very like having a pair of dice being thrown and each of the pairs coming out with 7. The gamblers amongst you, you'll know that is a very significant event, but equally each event is statistically independent. The factors that have led the Japanese economy to slow down, coincidentally with Europe and with the States, in my view, are quite different. In the case of Japan, the contraction of credit supply has been the prime factor that has led to the failure of economic growth. If you look at Europe, then the rather tight policies that inevitably had to accompany the early days of the single currency have been largely to blame. And if you look at the States, it has been the consequences of the capacity boom that we saw in 1999-2000 unwinding. Those factors are different. And the UK has, in this period, for a variety of reasons, had a degree of independence from those events. To begin with, we've had an element of counter-cyclical policy. Giles has already pointed out, and I think it's clearly a significant factor this year, that if you look at the combination of both fiscal and monetary policies for 2001, they are clearly different from those that you've seen in the United States. The degree of fiscal ease that we've seen this year, planned in previous years, has more than countered some of the more negative impact on private spending. And equally, we've had a different behaviour from the real exchange rate affecting our competitiveness. But over the last few years, we've also had a couple of independent shocks in the UK, starting with the decision to make the Bank of England independent back in 97, and that gave a positive shock to the economy at a time when the rest of the world hadn't gathered momentum. And subsequently, through the sale of mobile licenses, we've had a shock to the fiscal accounts, which has not had the impact many of us felt it was going to have in terms of long-term interest rates. And by that I mean that although it's helped to produce the lowest long-term interest rates since the 1950s and 60s, the one thing we have not yet seen in the UK is the return of a fixed 25-year mortgage rate at rates that are acceptable. We have not seen the ability to refinance our mortgage at a fixed rate over a lengthy period of time fall after the reduction in long rates, quite different from the United States, where refinancing mortgages is an easy and nowadays a very regular event. So there have been quite important differences during the recovery stage and in this down stage that separated the UK from the rest of the world. And partly because of that, I think it's understandable why we have been able to have one of the highest growth rates worldwide. But if we look out beyond that to saying, well, why are we now likely to get a degree of synchronization from which the UK cannot escape, there are a whole series of factors. The obvious one in terms of monetary policy has already been examined. But remember that during the response to the crisis in September, it wasn't just interest rates that changed. We also saw the regulation of many financial markets and indeed financial products instantly change. Solvency ratios for insurance companies in the UK were reduced. Capital adequacy ratios were reduced. We saw the redemption requirements for mutual funds in the States be eased. We even saw government intervention in some of the airline stocks and markets in continental Europe. We saw many of the things that back in the emerging market crisis of 98, Western governments were criticizing Asian economies for doing. They did precisely those things during the crisis of this year. So the monetary easing, both of regulation and indeed of interest rates, has been on a scale that inevitably is going to lead to some degree of synchronization. But that's not the only factor. The fall in the oil price, the impact of which is far greater than the tax cuts that have already been proposed, and the likelihood that that lower oil price will be secured for some time, means that you've had a coordinated fiscal boost. The fact that we now have, and have had in the last 5 years, economic growth financed far more by the capital markets than by the banking sector, means that when the capital markets start rationing credit, which they do much more ruthlessly than banks ever did, then again you get that coordinated, synchronized contraction in credit supply, which again adds to the degree of synchronization. And if you add to that the fact that many corporates have been on the same McKinsey program and know how to respond in terms of cost cutting and outsourcing to events such as this last year, it's not so surprising that you also get a coordinated corporate response. For all these reasons, I believe that we are now going back onto a synchronized cycle. And whereas you might have argued, and indeed the same was true in the last few years, that by having domestic growth deviate from export and international growth was a way of building in some degree of defensiveness, I rather doubt that we are going to get that degree of responsiveness to the domestic economy in the years ahead that many would hope and indeed require to provide a degree of insulation. And the reason I say that is that it's not just the events of September the 11th which have had an impact on people, but a whole series of events that are changing the tolerance for taking risk in normal lifestyles. We now have nearly 5% of the UK population that live in potential flood zones. Many of them are finding that they cannot get the insurance cover that they once thought they had, let alone that they now need. We have 10% of the population that have postal codes that are now finding that the ability to get the house and car insurance that they need is proving more difficult. We have a large proportion of the population that believe that private medicine might buy you a speedier response, but it's more expensive than they can afford, and indeed when it comes to emergencies it doesn't actually work or count. And we're also finding that because of failures within, I have to say, the financial community, that the confidence people have in building up savings pots for retirement has also been shaken by events in the last year or two. When you're faced with those degrees of increased risk in your normal everyday living, you shouldn't be so surprised if people behave differently and are less responsive to some of the stimuli that normally come their way when governments are trying to provide some degree of support. And all that is quite separate from any advice governments may have to give to living with some of the threats that we are now faced because of the events of this year, and which have the ability to shake consumer confidence simply by bringing home the fact that they live with those threats. So there's a whole series of issues that lead me to believe that we don't have the ability to insulate ourselves in the way we have in recent years, and that because of that, we are more likely to be drawn into this more synchronized cycle. Now, why do I say that we should be thinking not so much about this downturn as about the next? Because all the indicators that I think the markets have begun to respond to, particularly in the last week, have tended to suggest that this downturn may be surprisingly short, and hence that the bias is towards more recovery next year rather than a continued downturn. But my thesis would be not that that is an unlikely scenario, but rather that we are now going on a much more dramatic roller coaster in terms of global economies because of the increased synchronization than we have seen in the last 10 years. The last 10 years have been a remarkably stable 10 years in terms of global macroeconomic conditions. I doubt that the next 10 years is going to be quite like that. And hence, by virtue of that, I think the UK may well find itself riding this roller coaster. Why do I think we are likely to see a greater volatility in the cycle? Well, there are three factors that I'd highlight particularly. The first is that the volatility of corporate profits to GDP has increased. Part of that goes back to the McKinsey presentations, but most of it goes back to the degree to which we live in a much more competitive world, where economic power has very definitely shifted to the consumer, and he is far more demanding than he used to be. And hence the ability to be able to increase margins at the relevant stage of the cycle that you'd hope to do that is somewhat contained. Against that particular background, cost management is more extreme, and that basically means that they respond to the downturn far quicker, And they also provide a speedier response when the going looks somewhat more positive. So against that background, I think increased corporate profit volatility leads to a more volatile corporate spending cycle than we are used to. The second reason that leads me to believe that the cycle will be more volatile is the point I've already mentioned, that it's continuing to be financed far more from the capital markets than from the banks. A very rough and ready rule of thumb for 30 years used to be that something like 70% of the finance you needed for economic growth came from the banks and 30% came from the capital markets. You could reverse that in the last 5 years, and I think that the reversal has some permanency to it. The degree to which capital markets therefore ration credit is more ruthless, quicker, and by virtue of that, adds to the volatility in the cycle. But we're also about, in my view, to see credit being rationed to consumers. Although the capital markets have tended to take the strain as far as the corporate sector is concerned, the banking sector still faces a large amount of consumer debt, some of it built up over 20 or 30 year period, some of it isn't securitizable in the way that they had hoped, and hence the degree to which they may wish to fine-tune the customers that they have, let alone the debts that they have got, may well lead to credit supply to some categories of consumers being reduced, denied, or at the very least made more expensive. So the credit supply, I suspect, is going to be more volatile than it has been previously. And the third factor, and a factor that is particularly relevant after the emerging crisis of 98, but actually has a lineage that goes well before that, and in very stark contrast to the globalization impact that you saw between 1870 and 1910, the last great period of globalization, is that most of the FDI, the foreign direct investment flows that we have seen, have been between entities within the developed economy and not between the developed economy and the developing world. One of the big differences between 1817 to 1914 was that the foreign investment then went to the new world. In the last 20 years, and particularly since 1998, most of it has been between members of the G24. And inevitably, by virtue of that, those capital flows are clearly increasing the degree of synchronization, and we see it in the way that the correlations between equity markets and indeed bond markets have increased during this period. So for all these reasons, I believe we're going into a much more synchronized environment, and hence the ability of an open economy such as the UK to ride that particular roller coaster is diminished, not least because I don't think we're facing a liquidity trap in the UK, but I do believe that we're facing a risk trap, where people respond to all the events I've described and behave somewhat differently in their consumer spending habits. So my conclusion is, yes, we will survive this one. Yes, it's quite likely that we will be able to run very positively relative to our peers and contemporaries in the G7. But look out over the next 4 to 5 years, and I think that our degree of sensitivity is going to be somewhat greater. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Right, well now it's the turn of you in the audience. So if anyone would like to ask anyone up here a question or make some controversial statement, please do so. Yes. I think you have to wait for the microphone, if you don't mind.
Hello. We've just heard that corporates will or are relying more on the capital market and less on banks. I'm just wondering that whether this will start going the other way now or in the future may start going the other way because of the latest to come out on Basel, the amount of capital that banks require to lend to high-quality corporates.
Can Can I take that first?
Yes, please.
I don't think it's going to change quickly. If you look at the margins of the banking sector in the UK particularly, they are unbelievably high for this stage of the cycle. And the UK's bad loan, or UK banks' bad loan risk in this cycle is very low by comparison to the previous cycle, partly because of the previous cycle, but also because of the way that they have changed the way that they do their business. So I'd be very surprised, frankly, if you saw them going back down the corporate route very quickly. Either way, with most of them having capital investment operations, there's an indirect way for them to do it anyway. What I think is more likely is that you will see another wave of capital going into investment banking, which clearly has had a difficult year, if not 18 months. But if my scenario proves to be right, that spare capacity, spare capital within the banking sector, you'll find coming back out via the capital markets, not through traditional lending routes.
I mean, can I just add very quickly that I think you will get commercial banks just holding, I mean, as they do already, but perhaps possibly to an increasing extent, just holding highly rated corporate paper to take advantage of the lower Basel risk weighting. So in other words, you know, the corporates will issue debt, which will just be held by the banks, which, as I say, happens to some extent and will do so more.
Can I just add another point, actually? With the current shape of the yield curve, banks can make nearly a 30% return risk-free just by lending to governments.
Right. When I was at this place in the 50s, the ghost of John Maynard Keynes stalked the corridors, and Harold Wilson occupied the seats that you were sitting on, or one of the seats, which leads me to ask you, and I'm somewhat surprised that neither of you have mentioned the place of public expenditure in counter policy, countering this session, in particular the expansionary plans of Mr. Brown, which will be presumably very helpful in meeting needs in the schools, health service, transport, and presumably will be of some help in fending off recession. What are your views on this?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think that government spending does play a role, and I mean, I obviously didn't go into details, but showed the overall fiscal stance there, which in practice, as it happens, is being mainly influenced, in fact, entirely pretty well influenced by expansionary government spending. So I think your point is well taken, and I would certainly agree that that's one of the main reasons why I would regard policy as being very supportive and supporting the notion that Britain won't follow the world into recession.
Yeah, perhaps we didn't make a lot of it, but clearly it's one of the factors this year that we've had the degree of growth advantage relative to the rest of the G7 because of the public spending plans announced a year or two earlier. So clearly there has been a momentum there. I've got some concerns that people aren't going to behave and live quite as they did, not just because of the events of the 11th of September, but for a variety of other factors that I outlined. And hence the degree to which the public sector has to get involved in providing some insurance risk cover may be far greater going forward than has been the case in the past. Whether that is the equivalent of the spending programs of 40, 50 years ago is debatable. But I think there is a growing role for that. And in some marketplaces, I don't think that the market is working quite as quickly as you might have assumed it would have done. And hence, there may be an extended role for it.
Yes, please.
Really just following on from that point, because one of the things we've certainly seen in the UK in the last couple of years has been some pretty substantial increases in taxes, and also, as we've just been discussing, some pretty substantial increases in the amount of spending. I wonder if you'd like to comment on the UK's competitive position in the medium and longer term with the steady increasing rise of government spending as a percentage of GDP.
I'd add to that list because of the one message that keeps coming through a lot of companies that come in to see us is the regulatory cost of working within the UK, not simply the tax. But ironically, for many companies, the tax rates are very competitive, but the bureaucracy and the regulatory costs are increasing, and hence that's the issue for them. Whilst that trend continues, it's going to eat away clearly at our competitiveness. But I don't think we should underestimate just how big a step towards improved competitiveness had been achieved over the last 10, 15 years or so. And indeed, one of the reasons, I guess, exports have held in so well, despite very high real exchange rates, is simply a reflection of our flexibility and our willingness to respond to changed circumstances. So I don't think it's dreadful, but I think it is deteriorating slowly, and hence there is an issue there over time.
Did a panel think that commodities have ceased to be a leading indicator of economic growth, given the sort of new style of just-in-time management that McKinsey has instituted?
Interesting one. I actually think commodity prices are an excellent coincident indicator of global economic activity, and since actual data on the world economy comes through with sort of varying lags depending what you look at, commodity prices are usually a pretty smart way of tracking what's going on in real time. Now, having said that, we've obviously had a big bounce in metals prices over the last week or so, and one has to interpret that pretty cautiously, quite honestly. There have been some supply squeeze in there as opposed to sort of demand pickup, and quite a lot of sort of year-end short covering or whatever. So I think you know, there are moments when you, as it were, have to kind of just look behind the data and sort of interpret it a bit. So I'm quite happy with the idea that's those signals are telling us that activity is bottoming out. I don't think one should take this kind of big bounce quite at its face value.
I also think it's useful to differentiate between new commodities and old commodities. And the one thing we've seen in the last month is that DRAM prices, which has been collapsing for the last 2 years really, have started to recover. And if you look out to the Korean and Taiwanese markets, which were the first ones to really signal that the tech boom had burst, they're beginning to suggest a recovery. So somewhere in the system, you're beginning to see a demand for the newer new commodities. And that's quite hopeful.
I just wondered if the optimism shown by the panel will be tempered in any way if the UK joins the Eurozone.
I mean, I guess the good news here is that this is not going to happen, hopefully, in the course of the current cycle. So we probably don't have to worry about it over the next 12 months. I think, you know, if one looks further, I mean, although I suppose you could argue that anticipations of it might have some effect, for example, on causing the currency to soften or something like that. So I suppose there could be an anticipatory effect there, although since our Prime Minister and our Chancellor seem to contradict one another within usually sort of three twirls of the spin or whatever you call it on this topic, that there is usually very little information to affect anticipations. If you're looking further ahead and saying, would Euro membership affect the economy's ability to go counter to global cycles. I mean, that's a fascinating issue, and I mean, I guess sort of the conclusion is, well, you're obviously losing a degree of policy independence, but on the other hand, you're gaining a degree of influence over the policy of your major trading partner. And you have to somehow or other balance those two issues against one another. And I mean, the last time I looked at the sort of empirical studies on this was many moons ago. And as I recall, some of them came out saying that the one factor dominated and some said the other factor dominated.
I deliberately didn't include any reference to the euro in my contribution, largely because it normally sparks completely different debates than the one I was hoping to participate in. But quite clearly, if you wanted to get a degree of insurance against being drawn into the US roller coaster, than joining the euro in the next 3 or 4 years would give you that. But the political, arguably long-term economic consequences of doing it are clearly another consideration. But if you believe the roller coaster thesis, then the euro does offer you a degree of insurance. Whether it's worth taking is the debate.
To what extent do you think the current lower oil prices are playing a role in making this recession short-lived and shallow, as you said? And is it possible to talk about a ceiling above which, if oil prices climb, it would make it rather longer for the upturn to take place?
I think the lower oil prices are clearly helpful, as Michael said. I mean, they can be, you know, a shortcut to thinking about them is as a fairly significant global fiscal stimulus. So I think they are very helpful, and they have the added kind of kicker benefit of making the monetary policy makers around the world that little bit more able to be responsive, because it's reducing inflation risks. Clearly, as oil prices get very soft, and we're sort of kind of on the threshold of that, then you start to create a kind of discontinuity risks for a number of countries and companies. Some of the weaker oil exporting countries, you know, in Indonesia or Venezuela and so on, and perhaps some oil companies. So I don't think those discontinuity effects kind of swamp at the global level the sort of stimulative effects of lower prices, but they begin to become more of an offset. So I guess you get kind of diminishing returns to oil price reductions past a certain point. I mean, as for would a higher price choke things off, I mean yes. I mean, clearly, again, the thing works, you know, the other way around, and as prices move up, that acts as a dampening effect. If you're asking, is there a kind of discontinuous point at which, you know, if oil prices pass some level X, does that sort of somehow tilt the world economy into recession? And I think my response to that is there would have to be a kind of a discontinuity somewhere else. So, for example, if oil prices went up sufficiently that, I mean, in particular, the Fed would be required to operate negative interest rates in order to counter their effect, then you can think of as perhaps creating a sort of discontinuity level. So, I mean, and who knows, I mean, one could go away and try and estimate it. But short of that, I mean, it seems to me if oil prices are a bit higher, then you can counter that, you can just counter that with policy being a bit more stimulative, and you know, you after a short lag, things will sort of sort themselves out.
A very rough rule of thumb is that a permanent $1 a barrel reduction is equivalent in the States to something like a $9 billion tax cut. And the figures are somewhat less for Europe, something around seven for the Far East, about 5.5 for Europe. So if you start talking about a permanent $10 cut, 20-something to 10-something, you've got something much bigger than the tax cuts that have been proposed. Frankly, we've been living in a world of oil prices between $22 and $28 for some time. This time last year, we were outside that on the top end. Now we're below it. And I suspect that over time, for a variety of reasons, we may have to adjust to the trend being, or the range rather, being between 25 and 40, i.e. higher than the 22 to 28. But in current circumstances, to have that step change up is unlikely, let alone undesirable. I think the trend, after better part of 10, 15 years of going sideways, I think is to a higher equilibrium. And by virtue of that, I think you need to have policies that are designed to cope with it, and hence to provide the degree of permanent stimulus that would more than counter that trend over time. And I think we'll get it.
The pension funds are moving from investing in equities to bonds. Is this a temporary phenomenon? And if not, will it have an effect on economic growth?
Well, some pension schemes more than others have gone down that route. Inevitably, there's a move to more bonds because a lot of the schemes are now defined benefit schemes, their final salary schemes, and they're closed. So as they mature, the need to match the liabilities that are definable really requires you to have more bonds. Equally, at a time when you've got low inflation, the relationship between bonds and equities changes, and hence you get diversification benefits in a low inflation environment that you don't get in a high inflation environment. So I think the move towards bonds has a permanency to it. I don't believe many will follow the Boots example of going to 100% in bonds, because not all are able, nor are they willing, to take the sort of risks that Boots are now taking. But I think a move, not just to bonds, I have to say, but I suspect also to property, is a feature that we have seen in the last few years, and I suspect we'll see more of. The makeup of those bonds, they will change, and I suspect you will have far more corporate bonds than you will have government bonds, and hence you might argue that if that supply of credit is available to fund economic growth, then that development is a positive.
A follow-up question from the last lady. If you can consider asset valuations, and specifically stock market valuations, as the driving force behind an economy, and specifically the fact that as the asset prices rise, the wealth in the economy grows, then we look at what happened in Japan in early 1980s, the year 1990, where the Nikkei rose from around 10,000 to 40,000, and then suddenly it rose such a high level they realized they were flying and nothing was below them, and the whole economy collapsed. Could it not be regarded that step back 10 years or step forward 10 years and you look at where we are now, where the US is, where the Dow has rose from, say, 2,000 to around 10,000. You could say that we're actually today where Japan was 10 years ago. And literally what we're facing now is 10 years of stagnation and collapsing asset valuations. As I said, the stock market, especially if you regard it as self-fulfilling, that basically for every 10% rise in asset valuation, it creates so much wealth in the economy. A similar 10% drop would create so much asset destruction that it really does become self-fulfilling.
Well, I mean, if I can dive in on this one. I mean, first of all, just to sort of an information point, perhaps to say that I think it's by no means just stock market prices that are the sort of crucial asset price variable in the UK or many other places. I think house prices often play a critical role as well. So just make that point. I think the next point I make is that perhaps the role of certainly of equity prices, they can play a wealth effect role, but there's another very crucial effect that they play, which is they are, after all, the price of corporate assets. And while, as it were, a decline in stock market prices can be thought of as having a potentially negative effect on an economy because of the negative wealth effects, if we look to its other role, a decline in stock market prices, which brings them from an unrealistic or sort of bubble level down to a market clearing level, that can be regarded as actually being a healthy move for an economy because it allows transactions to take place, and specifically it allows capital to move into the hands of people who can make use of it. And certainly my analysis of Japan over the last 10 years would absolutely be that it suffered from not having asset prices coming down enough or quickly enough. Instead, both stock and land prices staying above what in some sense could be thought of as market clearing levels, and thus preventing bouts of overinvestment being kind of liquidated by the market and purchased by some other purchaser who could then make use of them. And I would regard the collapse in both the equity and debt of a number of, say, particularly telecoms stocks, I regard that as very healthy, because it means that the blatant overinvestment that these companies did is being bought up by someone else who in effect can wipe the balance sheet clear and get on and use those assets productively. So in that sense, I would draw a big distinction between Japan on the one hand and UK, US on the other, and argue that we will not get stuck in that bubble situation, that post-bubble situation.
You put your hand up slightly before.
thinking about what you've both been saying, I just wondered, is there anything that's keeping you awake at night which you could share with us?
I think Michael, having relayed his experiences in this auditorium to us, probably should go first on this one. But no. I mean, I think there are always risks to any scenario, and if we look around here, then clearly there's event risk. So there's clearly the risk that we could find that there's a new sort of Al-Qaeda sort of cell that's going to do something horrible at some point. And this kind of, we had a kind of very brief sort of moment of fear about that with this New York plane crash at the beginning of last week. Interestingly, the kind of conclusion from that perhaps was that is a worry, but if depending on the scale of it, that we perhaps don't have to worry too much. So anyway, so there's kind of event risk of that sort. And then I guess if we move on from there, I mean, we could, certainly we are at that point in the cycle that the sort of where real output has fallen sharply, a point where prices of many goods have come down massively, even though, as we mentioned, some of the sort of commodity and DRAM price and so on are sort of bottoming a bit. But anyway, prices have come down a long way, and also a lot of asset prices of one sort or another have shifted a lot. Now, when you get that circumstance, that's a kind of a danger point for the system throwing up financial nasties that are kind of hidden and which kind of by definition none of us knows about, but which kind of come out of the woodwork and hit us. And so, I mean, that certainly is a concern at the moment. And that will kind of be with us for, another sort of 3, 4, 5, 6, whatever it is, something like that, months. And then if we begin to get things sort of coming up, I mean, ironically, we may then see sort of, actual recorded bankruptcies, often increase at that stage as banks foreclose and so on. But we kind of then gradually begin to get out of that kind of financial nasty risk. One could go on, but I mean, do you, Michael, want to?
Well, I guess the thing that comes to mind is that when I left here, I joined the city in 73. In 73, 74 were very extreme years for financial markets and for financial institutions. And I fear that there will be another one. Funny enough, I don't think it's now. You obviously hear about cutbacks and downsizing and trying to get the cost base sorted out, and there's clearly an element of that. But if I'm right about the roller coaster, this has a look to it that makes it nearer to 1969-70 than 72-3. We've had the 68, we've got the 72 to come, and the 73-4 will follow that.
Can I just say one thing? Of course I can, because I'm the chairman. Those of you who remember the 1970s, remember a famous professor at Cambridge called Wynne Godley. In the late 1970s, he predicted that unemployment was going to rise to 3 million. And he was laughed at, but he was right. Now, today, Wynne Godley lives in the United States. And he is predicting that the US consumer is going to take fright at the very high levels of debt which the US consumer currently has, and that the US consumer will sooner or later rebuild his or her balance sheets, cut consumption dramatically, and the US will sustain a lengthy and very severe recession, which will then hit the rest of us. So there's something you might want to lose some sleep about, because he was right last time, so he might be right again.
Can I just respond briefly to that? Yes. And say, clearly there is a balance sheet adjustment going on for US, for US consumers at the moment. I mean, in the sense that the savings ratio has moved up sharply, and obviously the consumers benefited from tax cuts. It's now benefiting from this big oil price reduction. And so without wanting to, I certainly wouldn't want to cross that one off the list completely, but it seems to me it's kind of moved down the probability scale quite respectably in recent times.
Right. You wanted to... Oh, same question. Gosh. Why don't you discuss the microphones?
This is from Michael Hughes. When do you think the next downturn will come and the cycle's shortening? In your view, if we're out of this one, when's
the
next?
I think the next upturn is going to be a sharp and short-lived one. In other words, 2002-03, you'll see the recovery, and hence the downturn is a 3-4-5 environment.
Hello. To what extent do you expect that the effects of this slowdown will have a more pronounced and prolonged effect on the European countries, i.e. France and Germany, compared to the UK?
I think Germany is clearly a bit more exposed here. France perhaps a little bit less so, both more exposed in terms of its exporting industries. And in terms of its fiscal policy room for manoeuvre, neither of them has that much. But Germany, you know, is in actual risk, really quite real risk of breaking the 3% stability and growth pact limit for deficit as a percent of GDP. Whereas France helped a little bit by creative accounting, but even leaving that aside, is less close to that limit. So I draw a distinction between those two, and I would just make the comment that just as a matter of kind of fact, more or less in the data, I mean, it's clear that the euro area generally is obviously significantly weaker than the UK, and Germany in particular. And I think that partly does reflect that. It partly reflects that fiscal policy point, it partly reflects the export exposure point. It partly reflects the fact that, perhaps I was sort of hinting at in looking at some of those unemployment charts that there has been less room for the central bank there to maneuver, and therefore they haven't been able to respond there.
I think we've got time for one more question. So, yes, please.
Yes, it was your point actually, Professor Nicola, just touching on for the UK, that given the current imbalances in the UK, do you not think that increased borrowing to spend our way out of recession effectively could be storing up problems for the future and could leave the MPC with perhaps a rocky ride over the next few years?
What was your name again? All I would say to that is that the situation is plain that UK consumers have high levels of debt relative to income, but they have low interest rates, so their income gearing is relatively low. My guess is that, of course, there's always a risk that consumers in the future will do a serious rebuilding of balance sheets, in which case consumption will fall, just as Wynne Godley is predicting for the United States. My instinct is it's less of a risk here than it is in the United States. That's all I've got to say. Anyway, thank you very much for the speakers. I think we should give them a round of applause. And thank you, the audience, for asking such good questions.